You know, for instance, children and the Tooth Fairy, right? I tell my children that the Tooth Fairy actually have a sideline in making maracas, right? And that's what's inside maracas when you shake them, when you rattle them. And the reason, you know, they pay over here a pound a tooth, and that's why maracas are so expensive. It's a good story, don't you think?
That's author Jasper Ford giving us an example of the weird stories he comes up with. His new book, Early Riser, is not about the Tooth Fairy, but you'll be entertained nonetheless. It's what we're reading. This is What We're Reading, KAXE, KBXE's show all about books. I'm Tammy Bobrowski. On our program today, we'll hear from Anissa Gray. She'll talk about her debut novel of Sisters Coming to Terms with the Past. The Care and Feeding of Ravenously Hungry Girls is the title of her new book. We'll hear more from Jasper Ford. Early Riser is his new dystopic novel, imagining a world where it's winter all the time and people hibernate for 4 months out of the year. Pam Jenoff has an exciting new historical novel, The Lost Girls of Paris. It's inspired by a true story of a group of female secret agents working for the resistance during World War II. We'll hear from another debuting writer, Raymond Strom. His book, Northern Lights, is a 90s coming-of-age story taking place in the fictional town of Holm, Minnesota. And British writer Fiona Barton returns with another book in the Kate Waters series. It's a page-turning thriller called The Suspect. Our thanks to the Iron Mining Association of Minnesota, celebrating the past, present, and future of iron mining in Minnesota. More about mines and supporting businesses at taconite.org. Here's music from Lily and Madeline. Stay tuned for author Anissa Gray. Anissa Gray is an Emmy Award-winning journalist at CNN Worldwide. She began her career at Reuters, studied English and American literature at New York University, and currently lives in Atlanta, Georgia with her wife. Now she's diving into fiction writing with rave reviews. The Care and Feeding of Ravenously Hungry Girls is her debut novel. When Althea, the matriarch of the family, is incarcerated, sisters Violet and Lillian must come back home and take care of Althea's children, as well as come to terms with the painful memories of growing up. It's a story about family, love, and forgiveness. And Anissa Gray joins us now. Anissa, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
This is your debut novel. It's got an intriguing title. Can you tell us what the story is about?
The story is about what happens to a Michigan family after its matriarch and her husband are sent to prison on fraud charges. Her two sisters are forced to return home to deal with the fallout from that and raise the couple's two teenage daughters. What you see is a family sort of moving through the difficulties of forgiveness in some imperfect but ultimately, I think, some hopeful ways.
Your story is told through the perspective of each sister in alternating chapters. Can you tell us how each sister is different from the other? What roles each of these women have in their family?
Althea is the sort of de facto matriarch. She has taken over care for her. She's been caring for her sister since she was 12 years old. And then there is the middle sister, Viola, who is somewhat headstrong and has been away from home for many years. And then finally, there is the youngest sister, Lillian, who carries a great deal of pain and loss in some ways that her older sisters do not.
Is there a sister that you identify with the most?
I would say probably Viola, and that's largely because some of her story is rooted in my own. Viola is a sister who is in recovery from an eating disorder, and I suffered from an eating disorder from college until roughly I was 40 years old or so before I got treatment. So some elements of my story can be seen there. So I think she is perhaps the sister I identify with most.
I grew up with three older brothers, no sisters, so when I read books that feature sisters as main characters, I read them with both a little jealousy and relief. Can you explain what makes sisterhood such a powerful thing?
Well, I am from a family of five. I have three sisters and one brother. My relationship with my brother is just a little bit different, mainly because he was off sort of doing his own thing. But for my three sisters, while, you know, different factions can form amongst us just sort of depending on circumstances, at the end we all sort of feel like a gang of four. We all sort of circle the wagons when we need to. So there's a real sort of camaraderie there, I guess.
Right. You're listening to What We're Reading. I'm Tammy Bobrowski, and I'm talking with writer Anissa Gray. Her new debut novel is called The Care and Feeding of Ravenously Hungry Girls. Anissa, what are the girls in your novel hungry for?
With Viola, as I said, it's a literal eating disorder. With the other sisters, there's sort of this desire to fill the hollow spaces. They've all sort of endured loss. They've all endured betrayal. So it's a hunger for what's lacking, what's missing.
As you mentioned before, the oldest sister, Althea, and her husband are incarcerated, and then there's the fallout from that, taking care of their children. How does the family in your story, or really any family, survive and heal after extremely difficult times like that?
I think it's a sort of coming together. And you see that in the novel with siblings who are forced to sort of reckon with the past and find a way for forgiveness and deal with that and move forward to try to keep things together. So I think it's a lot of it is a willingness to find forgiveness and then go on from there.
You studied literature but became a journalist, a very good one. Mm-hmm. You've won awards by all accounts. Mm-hmm. How long has the story been bottled up in you?
This particular story, I guess this story was more of an evolution of a story, so I can't say it was bottled up for a long time. When I initially sat down to write this book, I was going to write a story about the sister Viola, who was recovering from an eating disorder, working as a therapist in an eating disorders clinic. But the story just wasn't coming together. It was just too narrowly focused. So it wasn't until I just sort of took a step back and started to view her through the lens of family, started to see her with her sisters and see that there was a much broader story to tell there. So for me, it was more of an evolution on at least this story. It was more of an evolution of a story, and it took me about 3 years to write it.
Are you working on a new book now?
I am, yes. I'm actually working on a novel now that I would prefer not to jinx by talking too much about it. But it also deals with family, a smaller family, and the disappearance of a father.
Great. We've been talking with journalist and writer Anissa Gray. Her new debut novel is getting a lot of buzz. It's called The Care and Feeding of Ravenously Hungry Girls. It's available now, published by Berkeley. Anissa, it's been a pleasure talking to you about your new book.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
You're listening to What We're Reading. I'm Tammy Bobrowski. Stay tuned. Later in the show, we'll hear from Pam Jenoff, Raymond Strom, and Fiona Barton. Up next, it's author Jasper Ford talking about his new dystopic book, Early Riser.
Upon my return from the age of ice, I supposed I would survive. I remember you with a feeling or two, free of hands without device. Slowly we all lay down. Slowly we all lay down. What of all the stone I invented to coat my hands and face? I was made of machine and gasoline, filled up full on just a taste. No, no, I wasn't born to break such bounds. Never would I prepare the leap. No, no, I wouldn't dare ever love you more, more than you would dare believe. Slowly we all lay down.
Jasper Ford is the New York Times bestselling author of Shades of Gray, The Air Affair, and over a dozen other books. His latest book is a thriller set in a world in which humans have always hibernated. It's called Early Riser, and Jasper Ford joins us now. Jasper, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you.
I got to tell you, after the weather we've been having here in northern Minnesota the last few weeks, I really connect with the idea of hibernating through the winter.
Yes. I remember once I was in Minneapolis, St. Paul, over Easter, and I got a day off, and we went to the zoo, and we saw the saddest moose I have ever seen. It literally had snow on its back. So I when I saw that moose, I thought, right, okay, I've got an idea about what winters are like here. And that was only in Easter.
Oh, goodness. You got it. So Early Riser has a really interesting premise. Harsh winters ravage the globe. Humans have always hibernated for 4 months out of the year. Tell us more about the story.
Sure, absolutely. I usually write books by something that I call the narrative dare, right? This is something that I think I've invented myself. And what I do is I just set myself a little dare, and then I kind of throw myself into this pit and then try and write my way out of it. So Early Riser is the narrative dare is write a thriller in which humans have always hibernated. And I just love the idea of that, of humans hibernating. But the interesting word in that sentence, I don't think is like humans or hibernating, but always. And the fact that we've always done it means that it's completely normal. It's fraught with danger, as you'll find in the book. But to the people who are in my book, to Charlie Worthing, my protagonist, it is entirely normal. And we see this real world very much through their eyes. So it's 4 months of the year. It's a very cold world. It seems as though we were sort of slipping into an ice age. Climate change is very real, but working in the other direction. And my character, Charlie Worthing, joins the Winter Consuls, who are a group of people who look after the sleeping masses. So you could be one person in charge of 500,000 people who are all asleep in these big dormitoria. But because this, of course, is a bit of a thriller, there are always a bit of sort of mischief. There's a bit strangeness, a bit of darkness always in the winter. So it's really just sort of playing with that notion of being anyone. If anyone who's listening has ever worked night shift, it's kind of like that. But imagine being on a night shift for like 4 months, and it's a bit strange, and the people you share it with are a little bit odd as well. And it's this strange, weird, off-kilter world in which you may not survive. Always at the back of your head is this idea that you may not survive. But Charlie has to do the best, and do the best Charlie does.
Now, where did you get the idea for this story? What inspired you?
I'm not 100% sure. It was actually, there are several ideas. There's this notion of a viral dream, because in Early Riser, to allow you to survive to the spring, you take a drug called Morphinox, which allows you, because you don't want to, you have to bulk up in the autumn, of course, to survive through to the spring. But what Morphinox does, it lowers your energy requirements by stopping you dreaming. And I like the idea that you need to dream. And I like the idea of viral dreams. So Charlie is actually starting to get this viral dream. So that was kind of one idea. Then I had this other notion about what humans would do as hibernate, how we'd be different, you know, socially, economically. And these kind of ideas kind of just mull around in my head for maybe 3 or 4 years. And I'd write a few notes here and there. And I think, right, how can I sort of get them all together? And then eventually I say, right, okay, come on, Jasper, you know, pull your finger out. Let's start writing this and see where it ends up. So it was really me just writing this world, this very, very strange world. And then I found the drama and the plot actually started to come off the world, because the exciting thing about writing fantasy is that you're changing drama because you're injecting a little difference. You've got humans, but they're slightly different. And that difference, the hibernating, then creates this whole new set of dramatic possibilities, which I really enjoy. So I kind of write the world first, and then the plot sort of semi-drops in my lap.
Well, let's talk about these worlds. You are known for creating fun and fantastical worlds and quirky characters. Where does this come from? How do you do this? Are these people that you know, or places that you've just been imagining?
I think it's... I always had a... As a child, I always had a very, very vibrant imagination. And I'm not sure where that came from. But I was the kid at school who would, rather than tell sort of one-liners, I would say something, you know, wouldn't it be strange if, and then have this sort of bizarre notion. And everybody would kind of look at me slightly askance and say, yeah, okay, that's a bit of a strange one. But, you know, for instance, children and the Tooth Fairy, right? I tell my children that the Tooth Fairy actually have a sideline in making maracas, right? And that's what's inside maracas when you shake them, when you rattle them. And the reason, you know, they pay over here a pound a tooth, and that's why maracas are so expensive. It's a good story, don't you think?
Yeah.
So it's this way of taking two things, two ideas, and then merging them together, and an exciting new possibility pops out. And I do it all the time when I'm sort of, you know, walking down the streets and doing whatever I do. And I just think it interests me, you know, taking these ideas and just playing with them.
That was New York Times bestselling author Jasper Ford. His new book is called Early Riser, and it's available now through Viking Press.
Takes a fine imagination and a sound technology to let loose the cold amnesia over all the blood that beats. Slowly we all lay down.
That was Tao and the Get Down, Stay Down with Age of Ice. You're listening to What We're Reading on KAXE, KBXE. I'm Tammy Bobrowski, and I encourage you to visit our What We're Reading page on Facebook, where some of our recent recommendations and reviews include So Brave, Young and Handsome by Leif Anger, recommended by Johnny, Bear Town by Frederick Backman, recommended by Peter, and Where the Crawdads Sing by Delia Owens. This was recommended by Donna, whose book club recently read it and declared it one of their best reads in years. We'd love to hear what you're reading. Join us at KAXE, KBXE, What We're Reading on Facebook. Coming up next, writer Pam Jenoff on her new work of historical fiction, The Lost Girls of Paris. Pam Jenoff is the best-selling author of books such as The Commandant's Girl, The Things We Cherished, and The Orphan's Tale. Her new book is The Lost Girls of Paris. It's a work of historical fiction, part mystery, part spy novel, about a group of female agents deployed out of London during World War II to aid in the resistance. And Pam joins us now to tell us about her new book. Welcome, Pam.
Thanks so much for having me.
The Lost Girls of Paris revolves around 12 women in covert operations in London, recruited to help the resistance in Paris, but you also introduce a character from New York, Grace, who finds herself connected to these women. Can you tell us what role Grace plays in The Lost Girls of Paris?
Certainly. So The Lost Girls of Paris is actually told from three points of view. One of the women who served SOE in occupied France in 1944, the spy handler in London, Eleanor, who goes looking as to what happened to the women who served SOE, and finally, as you've mentioned, Grace. And Grace is a very different character. She's what I refer to as not quite a war widow, in that she lost her husband during the Second World War, but she didn't lose him to combat. She lost him in a pre-deployment accident. And so Grace is living in New York City, struggling with her grief and guilt and trying to figure out what comes next when she finds an abandoned suitcase in Grand Central. In the suitcase are pictures of 12 young women, and outside the suitcase, on the outside, is scrawled the name Trig, which is the name of the spy handler. And so Grace sets out to find out who the women are in the pictures and what Eleanor Trig might have been doing in New York City.
I read that The Lost Girls of Paris is inspired by true events. Can you tell us about those events behind the story?
The actual story that inspired the Lost Girls of Paris is that of the British Special Operations Executive, or SOE. The agency was created in 1940 by Winston Churchill, in his own words, to set Europe ablaze. And he wanted these agents to drop behind enemy lines to engage in sabotage and subversion, with the goal being to sort of slow down the Germans and weaken things across ahead of the Allied cross-channel invasion. And so they started SOE with male agents, but men were quite easily detected on the streets of occupied France, where the local men were oftentimes away, either imprisoned or conscripted. And so the idea came up to send women, which was quite a radical notion at the time, and they sent women in as SOE agents to do the work. They did a really good job. They were radio operators and couriers and saboteurs, and ultimately they became a very prominent target for the German counterintelligence, and there were betrayals, and many of the agents were arrested. They were arrested in large numbers, and many never came home, including about 12 of the women.
Now, do we know how many women served in that capacity?
Officially with the agency, I'm going to say about 40. Of course, there were women doing all sorts of other work and that sort of thing, but I believe there were about 40 women who served SOE.
And why do you think events like this are hidden from popular history?
Well, you know, women often played such an important but unseen role in world events and war and struggles, and this was certainly a case of that. They really had no official status when they were sent, and so for a number of years after the war, it was hard to get them official recognition. There has been a great deal in history written about these women in a nonfiction sense, but we're only just now sort of seeing it in popular culture.
We're talking with writer Pam Genoff. This is What We're Reading. Her new novel is The Lost Girls of Paris. It's a work of historical fiction about a group of female secret agents working for the resistance during World War II. So what is it about historical fiction that keeps you excited to continue doing this research and writing?
Well, I particularly enjoy writing about women in historical fiction. So if you think about it, a woman in a historical time probably would have lived on a very set trajectory, a very traditional path, but through war or other catastrophe, she's thrown off that path and changed and challenged and tested in ways that she simply could not have anticipated. And so as a writer, I really enjoy that piece of it. And then specifically with respect to World War II, you know, one of the great things is that as a storyteller, we can take our reader and put him or her in the shoes of the protagonist and have the reader ask, what would I have done? And World War II has such dire circumstances and such stark choices that it's just really fertile ground for storytelling.
Yeah, I can really get that sense of what you're saying, because early in the book, I believe your character Marie, who is one of the operatives,
yeah,
she kind of has a chance to back out. She thinks to herself, what am I doing here? And you almost want her to back out, but she realizes that what she's doing is really important for her child and for the future, and so she sticks with it.
Well, one of the interesting things was to look at sort of how they found the women and why the women volunteered. You know, they didn't have natural pipelines from the colleges and the military like they did with the men. And these women came from all walks of life in Britain, you know, with eyes wide open, knowing that at times the life expectancy of an agent once they were deployed might only be a few weeks. And to think about why wives and mothers and daughters, you know, volunteered for this work, whether it was patriotism or to avenge someone or, you know, some other duty, is very interesting.
Now, what do you think is the biggest challenge to writing historical fiction?
Historical fiction sort of has a whole other job built in, you know, as opposed to contemporary fiction in the research. And of course, the research is different every time. But I always say that there's really three challenges with historical research for fiction. One is how to do the research. And secondly is how to weave the material in that I find without doing sort of a big dump of material just because I think it's really interesting that will stop the story from flowing forward. And the third challenge is how not to mess up in historical research for fiction, because no matter how many times I go over it and we go over it, there's inevitably a mistake somewhere in there.
Do you get feedback from people on things that might not be as accurate as they'd like?
Right, or some are actual inaccuracies that they find, and some are perceived inaccuracies. But it's funny, I think years ago people used to write to me privately, and now they tend to post it on Goodreads or, you know, Facebook or Amazon or somewhere like that.
That was Pam Genoff, best-selling author, talking about her new book, The Lost Girls of Paris, available now through Park Row Books.